Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by Roy Price. Now, Roy he runs this great Substack. I read pricepoint.substack.com. Go check it out. But the reason it's so interesting is because Roy was for many years. He founded Amazon Video. You also founded Amazon Studios, yes?
Yes.
And I love Amazon Studios. I was just looking back at that first run of movies that Amazon Studios did. I remember seeing Chirac in theaters, and Friendship in theaters. That was a real interesting time. And we're going to talk about what that might look like today, I think. Mm-hmm. Roy, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Sonny. I'm a frequent listener.
So, that's very nice of you to say. So, here's why I wanted to have you on the show. You put out on your Substack, you had a really interesting essay this week about what it would look like to start a studio today. What if you wanted to start a studio today? What would you try to do? How would you try to do it? And it's an interesting question because it does feel like there is a big space in the low to mid budget range. A24 style or Blumhouse style studio, and yet we have all of these movies coming out that cost $100 million, $150 million, $200 million. What would you, if you were looking to start a studio today, again, kind of like you did with Amazon Studios, what would that actually look like?
Well, I think first you have to figure out, you know, what gap in the market you're filling and what you're good at. So, why does the world need this studio? Because the world doesn't per se need another studio that is just going to make like generic films. So you have to have a specific identity and plan. And, traditionally, if you think of media brands that have started, they've followed this pattern, going all the way back to Max Sennett and Keystone, Pictures or Casablanca Records or whatever. You know, you should have a vibe and something that you're about and bringing to the world. And if you look at the market today, I would say there are definitely things that are missing. There are kind of, I'd say, gaps that you can see, and then maybe opportunities in the future that we could speculate about. But I think probably the most obvious one is comedy, which has gone from about 20% of box office to about 6%. And to take a step back, by the way, the premise, of course, from my point of view, is that movies are back, theatrical is back. You know, you can see Barbie and Oppenheimer and a lot of titles actually doing well. And so I take that as a premise. And then looking at the titles, looking at what everybody is doing, I think, you know, comedy is probably at the core of the opportunity, but I think there are other opportunities around that.
Well, comedy is interesting. I mean, I saw somebody talking the other day, an actor, name escapes me, but he was saying, look, comedies are kind of dead at the box office right now because Marvel has eaten up that space. And it's true if you look at comedy as a genre, right? It's been kind of absorbed into, we don't have a lot of pure comedies anymore. It's comedy superhero. It's comedy action. It's comedy, whatever, but it's the actual pure comedy space has kind of withered because it's been absorbed into so much else.
Right. But, we could do like The Hangover, Tropic Thunder, Airplane, Blazing Saddles, like comedies that are actually super funny. I have there's no reason to believe that there is not still a huge market for that. And so I think that, I mean, yes, other movies like an action movie like Everything Everywhere should have a sense of humor. And so there are a lot of things that can be somewhat funny. But I think there's an opportunity for, you know, movies that are more traditionally comedies like a Stripes or a Fletcher or Ghostbusters or what have you.
Mm-hmm. I mean, No Hard Feelings has done okay at the box office. It
yeah,
opened
okay.
a little soft and has kind of held on.
Yeah, and that's kind of really, you have to give Jennifer Lawrence a lot of credit for that because, like, I don't really even get the premise.
So the idea, the first idea here is to have an identity for your studio. I mean, I feel like that's the sort of thing that's easy to say, but hard to visualize and vocalize. I mean, like when you're looking at the marketplace right now, yes. All right. So there's the gap for comedies, but you know, what market niche would need to be filled, do you think, by one of these studios, a new studio?
Well, I think that, you know, that's the core of it. I also think that, I think that's the number one thing. And then I think there are opportunities in, you know, if you look at action, a lot of it is, tonally, very kind of international and sort of sophisticated. Even John Wick, you know, it's all about like the Russian mob, and Hitman's Bodyguard is like in Europe. And I know this is just my instinct and people can disagree, but I think there's an opportunity in like just kind of regular American, like I almost feel like, and I can't prove this, but I almost feel like, you know, when, what was that Springsteen album, like Born in the USA or whatever came out, there's kind of a little bit of an incipient vibe out there that I think is not being served very much. And we saw it maybe a little bit in Top Gun. I think it's in the aesthetics of Barbie a little bit. That's just kind of very, you know, traditional in a way. And like those, you know, like trucker movies, like Smokey and the Bandit or Walking Tall, just like, you know, we're not in Bruges. We're not doing Sexy Beast in like the South of France. We're, you know, we're like in Texas, and there's, you know, like, I think there's an opportunity to just do some fun American action stories that is out there as well. They're just kind of next door to comedy. And some of them could be comedies, but my instinct is that we're not seeing a lot of that either. And you know, there's this whole thing of like stuff that Everything Everywhere was taking part of, which is kind of meta modern and fun and having fun with itself. And I think there's a lot of stuff down that road as well. I think there's really fun Japanese movie called Gintama that I recommend that is fun to see along those lines. So, you know, what is more difficult is stuff right now, I think, that is like super serious. I think this is just not the moment for it. We've seen a lot of movies bite the dust over the last year that are just too heavy or nostalgic, you know, whether it's, you know, not to be critical of anyone, but even stuff like, you know, I don't know, Armageddon Time or Fablemans or, you know, even stuff like Nope, I Hurt Your Feelings or something. Like, I think people really want something a little more high energy, cinematic, fun right now. Like, that's a pretty clear signal. And it's, you don't want to overread because you're making a movie that's going to come out 2 years, but that's really my sense of the market right now. So if you're starting a studio, to get back to your question, I think you want to focus on this zone that we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, there was a point that you made either in this newsletter or a previous one that the range of nostalgia now is so narrow that when you say nostalgia, whose nostalgia?
Right.
Whose nostalgia are we talking about? You know, and with the marketplace as kind of, you know, segmented as it is, how that actually works how nostalgia works in a new movie is very interesting and very hard to kind of quantify and explain to people.
Yeah, I mean, nostalgia feels risky to me because, you know, what you're nostalgic for may not be what I'm nostalgic for. So, you know, if you're a master, you can probably, you know, like in you know, the movie about Sicily with the theater that burned down, the famous Italian movie, Cinema Paradiso, you know, makes you nostalgic for like Sicily in the 50s or whatever it was. So, you know, if you're really great, you can make it work. But in general, I'm not nostalgic for the 60s because I was not, you know, I didn't live through that. Right. So, you know, that's a real challenge. And in general, I think it's a tough road. You know, I mean, maybe if we're going to do the 90s or something. Yeah. You know, like if you look, look at like Wonder Years, how many years prior, how much of a look back was that? It's not usually like 60 years, you know, or like how many years back was like Greece? It's like 10 or 20 years. Anyway, I worry a little bit about that. And as I said, you know, talent and quality trumps everything else, of course. But as a guideline, we've seen a few trip ups in that zone over the past year.
Well, it's interesting too. If you look at, you know, let's look at a couple of the biggest hits of the year so far, right? Super Mario Brothers obviously is a huge hit, but that's a movie that also appeals to people who grew up playing Super Mario Brothers in the 1980s or 90s or aughts, or something like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, smaller scale success, but still looks like it's going to be a pretty decent hit here. And that's something that appeals to, you know, kids who watched the cartoon in the 90s, played with the toys in the 90s. I mean, those are types of nostalgia that seem to work. Or Barbie. Yeah. But I mean, Barbie is a, you know, that is a generations spanning thing, I think.
Yeah. And that's like IP. So I would put that in a different category from like societal nostalgia. So you have a particular toy or something that people played with and they're familiar with and they like it and they want to see the movie. And that does seem to be working so long as you're, you know, keeping it fun and, sort of, you know, playing to the audience that is the fan base. I mean, obviously like Indiana Jones tried to do the same thing and I think ran into some, difficulties and I guess The Flash as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's. Well, that, you know, that brings me to the next point in your newsletter, which is scope and scale, size. Like the size of these movies has certainly gotten out of control on the higher end of things. But even you know, even something like Babylon, right? Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is a big success, but that's a tough one. That's a you know, you need two stars and Quentin Tarantino, and you know everything else. What should studios be looking at in terms of size and scale? If you're looking to get started, you've got, you know, I've just won the Mega Millions. I have $500 million to play with. I want to start a movie studio. What are my first five projects budgeted at?
Well, I mean, you know, it does depend how much money you have. So if you have, you know, there is this type of movie that is, you know, prestige director, big actor or three, and it's $100 million or a little more. And so it's Babylon, it's Oppenheimer, it's like Wolf of Wall Street, Scorsese's new picture. And often these pictures do work, you know, so Oppenheimer worked, Wolf of Wall Street worked. I can't remember the budget of Amsterdam, but I'm going to kind of throw it into the same category. I think the budget was a little lower, but, you know, it's, you know, so what you're saying, if you're making the movie for 100, is so now you have to gross, like, let's say 130, 140. So that's like twice as much as The Big Short. So The Big Short, in my opinion, was a super successful film. Also, Everything Everywhere was like 77, right? Mm-hmm. So we're saying we're going to be almost double Everything Everywhere and The Big Short. Those are very successful films. I think if you're doing that, you're either doing that because you don't care. You have some other goal. You know, you're like, you're a streaming service and you really want to win an Oscar. Or like the people who finance like Wolf of Wall Street, you know, no offense to anyone, but like some of the people behind that, like there was some like financial scandal behind it, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So like they didn't really care. You know, you've got to have a different sense of risk. If you're actually a real life studio that intends to make money in movies, I think that kind of movie, which, you know, you might hear about two or three times a year, is probably not a great idea. It could be a winner, but probably in the best case scenario, where you get a box office of, let's say, 150, you're making a very small amount. I think even Gatsby would probably, you know, be about break even at that level. Yeah. So that's not really, you know, I mean, the opportunity to lose a lot is pretty significant there. Because, you know, I mean, what if you gross 40? You know, then you're really out a lot. So I think you're better off, you know, with, you know, Everything Everywhere was like 14. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the original John Wick, this is several years ago now, but it was around 14, 15 as well. Mm-hmm. And I think, well, talk about several years ago, but like, you know, Pulp Fiction or Reservoir Dogs in that zone, right?
Right.
And you can do a lot of comedies in that zone as well. And you can even kick it up to, let's say, 30. And, you know, and there's a lot to choose from. I think that La La Land was somewhere between 30 and 40.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe you could get it down to 30 and hopefully get it into your zone. For this theoretical, you know, new studio, but I think at that level where, you know, you break even at, you know, 28 to 42 at the box office, and anything above that is, you know, profit. Those are like that, you can see that happening. That can work.
Yeah. One thing you talked about is the economy of scale. Like how many? So when you're making movies, you know, you're better off making 10 movies and hoping one or two hit to make up for the you know, the rest that either break even or don't. If you're sitting down, you've got, you know, a big pile of money. What is the number of films you're looking to release a year? In the hopes of hitting, you know, break even, we get to keep doing this for another year.
I think 10 to 12 is a good goal. I think there are some companies in Hollywood that, you know, they do like three. And the problem with that is it's just very risky. You know, I mean, showbiz is kind of like... insurance or something, where, like, you know, if you made a bet that somebody was going to die before a certain point in time, that would be weird and risky, right? But if you did that 100,000 times, you'd be an insurance company, right? And you'd have like a predictable, very predictable business. And in the movies, if you bet on one, it's unpredictable and risky. But if you have 10 or 12, it becomes more predictable. And I just think, you know, if you have three, I'm not sure it quite gets to the threshold of starting to be a sort of, you know, a business. You know, I mean, it just feels like it's a very, very, very concentrated bets at that point. So I feel like those entities should probably like get together, like, you know, just be part of one entity. I don't understand why they're independent. Because it feels like about the right size is at 10 to 12. And traditionally, when people have tried to go above 10 to 12, their quality has deteriorated. So there aren't a lot of examples of people like going to 40 and really having a lot of great movies come out of it.
I want to drill down onto one thing here just for layman audiences, because I myself am a layman, and I try to target it at the layman. When you're in your newsletter, you talk about the difference between just being a production company and being a distributor. And when you're a distributor, you know, you basically have green light power. You can say, we're going to make this movie. When you're a production company, you're waiting on Warner Brothers or Paramount or whoever to sign off, and then you've got to sell it. You got to sell foreign rights and et cetera, et cetera. Could you explain to folks a difference here between, like, if you're sitting down, you're like, all right, I'm going to make 10 movies a year and I'm going to distribute them myself. What are some of the challenges there in terms of getting things actually out to people, to theaters, to the viewers?
Well, I mean, let's say we have a script, we have an actor, we have a director, and we have a $10 million budget, and we have $10 million. Okay, now we have everything we need, you know, to make this movie. However, we want some reassurance that once we put the money into the movie and then we have a movie, that we're then going to be able to receive money back. And that requires distribution. And for theatrical distribution, it requires someone to put up money for marketing the film. And so either in scenario A, you are your own distributor and you're going to do that, or B, you have to go and ask these other people to support you as your partner in that way. And very similar thing for foreign, right? But in scenario B, you are not really in control. Like, you can't really greenlight anything. You know, you're simply a guy who is going and asking this other guy if you can make your movie. And it depends entirely on that person saying, yes, I'll, you know, take it out to theaters, blah, blah, blah. And it's a little suboptimal because it is not as good. Because, you know, the more people who get to weigh in, the closer to the mean you're going to be, the closer to the average decision-making process you're going to be, right? Because, you know, your company, in theory, is going to do well if you have a distinctive point of view that is unique and valuable, okay? But if instead that is watered down because you have to conform with all these other random people whose approval you require, then you're going to wind up with a bunch of films that are less a distinctive representation of, let's say, your point of view, and much closer to just, you know, average films. And remember, the rewards in showbiz do not go to the average. They go only to the top. This whole strategy, this structure that has been set up, really undermines the opportunity to be distinctive. Now, you could wind up being distinctively bad. Like, you know, you could have a horrible run, and these distributors could have saved you from your horrible decisions. But, you know, we're looking at the other scenario where, you know, you're on a genius run.
Okay. Well, let's assume for the sake of argument here that I've got the genius talent. We've got these movies. As a neophyte distributor, what do I need to do to make sure that these things get into theaters? I mean, is it just going to CinemaCon and being like, hey,
theater owners, look at these great movies I've got. You got to put them in your theaters. Like, how does that actually work?
Yeah, you say, look, I have, you know, Scarlett Johansson and you know, Wes Anderson, and here's what it's about. Here's the trailer, and we're supporting it with $20 million of marketing, and we're looking to open October 7th. What do you say? And, you know, you'll get screens. There's a little problem right now that some theaters have gone away, like the Cinerama Dome, what was called the Arclight at the end in Los Angeles, and the Landmark on Pico in Los Angeles. So this particularly is detrimental for what you call the indie or artsy segment. So you see pictures like The Worst Person in the World and Triangle of Sadness kind of underperform. And I'm not ascribing that entirely to two theaters, but it is, you know, it's a little bit of an issue right now with a particular zone of movie. And so, again, that's another reason that zone is kind of the laggard. And you want to have a movie that is appropriate for, you know, a little less Film Forum in New York and a little more, you know, AMC 15 in Century City.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what is the state of platforming right now? So what you're describing, right, is kind of platforming, right? You open in New York and in L.A. in four theaters, and you do $60,000 per screen if you're lucky, and then you spread out a little bit. It feels like that model has kind of broken a bit in the COVID era. I mean, you still see some success there with like Everything Everywhere All at Once kind of steadily grew. But that is definitely a segment of the market that feels a little bit weaker now than it did, say, when, I don't know, like Black Swan was able to get up to 140 million or whatever that made domestic, you know, after opening in two theaters. Is it just a function of that indie audience not being there right now, or is there some other structural issue at play?
Well, I think in the true indie zone, so Triangle of Sadness or whatever, or, you know, like Yorgos Lanthimos has a picture coming up imminently. You know, I think post-COVID we're just starting over. And I think most things seem to be back and functioning. So with the exception of, we've lost a couple thousand screens in total in the US, including some important ones. But otherwise, you know, people know where their theater is and they seem to be going to the theater. So we've had some really good weekends recently. And so it is possible that a platforming strategy where you just go out to six theaters or whatever could work. We could see some successes later this year with some prestige pictures in December. I can imagine that. And it's just a little harder because we have some missing screens to place those movies. But I'm sure people will figure it out somehow.
Yeah. I mean, one thing you've also talked about is just the decline in award season audiences in general. I mean, movies like Tar, which I loved, one of my favorite movies of last year, or Triangle of Sadness. I mean, like, you know, movies that are getting award season consideration, but aren't getting the kind of traditional award season bump at the box office.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, look, the award shows are viewed by like 25% the number of people who used to view them. And so the bump you get from awards attention is just not what it was. So that's unfortunate. And it's another thing that sort of militates against that kind of movie, you know, which is why, you know, we might have to wait a season or two for, you know, that kind of thing, or really that, you know, certain types of things may really have to go over to streaming or to television or something. You know, there may be things that would have been made 15 years ago that would not be made today. It just wouldn't make sense to make them for theatrical today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're safer if you do have some, you know, bigger element of fun, you know, whether it's Everything Everywhere or Oppenheimer or, you know, whatever it is, that it makes it a little more cinematic and brings people to the theater. You know, so I'm not sure you're going to see, you know, The English Patient, King's Speech. I think that gets into slightly tougher territory. I think Manchester by the Sea, I think you would do, because it's a super high quality, but I think I'm not sure it would do like 45 million, which is what it did when it came out.
Well, I mean, I get the sense that Netflix is kind of cornering this market, right? I mean, you're with your Romas, Irishman, Power of the Dog, right? That sort of like prestige, kind of traditional. All Quiet on the Western Front, another one right there, right? Like, you got a ton of Oscar nominations, won a bunch of technical awards, but would not necessarily be something that you could release in theaters to a mass audience and hope to make your money back.
I mean, you know, there's an audience for Roma or Western Front for sure. They've always had a sort of hostility to theatrical that I don't totally understand. I mean, in my opinion, if you release, you know, at Amazon Studios, we released almost every movie to theaters because I think that customers view a movie that, you know, went to theaters and, you know, got reviewed and stuff as like a real movie. And something that you release straight to TV is television. You know, it's different. And they value it differently. They perceive it differently. And, but we've never agreed on that.
Yeah. Well, let's dive into this a little bit, because as I mentioned, you know, Amazon Studios, I remember that first, like, real, very solid run of movies, you know, and we're talking about movies, made for okay budgets, modest budgets, with well-known directors like Spike Lee doing Chirac, with Stillman doing Love and Friendship. You know, Manchester by the Sea obviously was a big hit, both commercially, critically, award season wise. And as you say, those all go into theaters. They are varying levels of success, but at the very least, it, you know, gets the brand and the movies themselves out there. When you were looking at the strategy for the studio, you know, you've already got the streaming service Prime Video there. You could have put these on streaming directly. Instead, you go for the theatrical route. What was your thinking there?
It was really that, you know, customers are going to value these more if they're real movies, and real movies go to theaters. And if you want to win awards, I think if you skip theaters, it just really reduces your chance. Not to zero, but particularly at the time, I think it you know, you're better off going to theaters. So it made sense in almost all cases to go to theaters. And, you know, for us, we were, you know, we wanted to have an original movie program, but within a budget constraint. And so we were focused on doing, you know, special films that had, you know, were kind of in that indie prestige segment. And that became like part of our brand at the time. And so that's the area that we were focused on. So so Manchester and The Big Sick and some others.
The Neon Demon. I just pulled up the list again, because that 2016 run is I mean, it's just it's wild to look back at. Patterson, another night, really, really fun.
Patterson, we had a Mike Lee picture in there.
Yeah, The Handmaiden, Park Chan-wook. I mean, yeah, that's, you know, Park Chan-wook. That's a, and again, it seems very, the sense I get, again, just looking back at this list now and thinking about it is, you know, look, you're looking at films made by auteurs with name recognition within a pretty tight budget range, you know, I don't know what, 5 to 20 million, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that seems to be like what you're talking about now. For if you are going to start a studio, if somebody came to you with a, you know, here's a big pot of money, this is the sort of thing we should be making.
Yeah, except that now, you know, 1 year we had 6 pictures at Cannes. We were definitely in that zone, you know. What I think I would do differently today, and, you know, somebody else would have a different plan, you know, is many more of those movies would be trying to go after that Hangover, Tropic Thunder vibe, because it's not on the market and it's great and people really want it. I think it's the thing that's missing. And some of those movies would have to be made at lower budgets, or they wouldn't be made. Some of the, you know, if it's too talky or it's too much of a downer, I just think it's not for this moment. You know, you may have to wait a year. You know, maybe people will come around. You know, but you know, like Tar and stuff. It's just not the moment for that kind of thing. So, yeah. I think a much...
Unless, of course, you've got Christopher Nolan making Oppenheimer. I mean, yeah. Oppenheimer, talky, a little bit of a downer, and that movie is blowing up. But, I mean, that's...
There is a special Christopher Nolan exception. And, you know, listen, with every rule or guideline or whatever opinion you have, you know, tomorrow, you know, Margot Robbie and Christopher Nolan walk in, obviously, whatever, it's all good, you know, or we're probably going to move forward.
I want to focus a little more on the Amazon Studios versus Amazon Video distinction here, because I'm fascinated by the business of streaming. In many ways, it doesn't make any sense to me at all, and I don't understand it. But in other ways, it makes a lot of sense. It makes perfect sense. My big question for you is, when you were looking at what worked for Amazon Video in terms of acquiring and keeping subscribers, what were you guys looking for? Was it new original series? Was it did films perform well as acquisition materials? Or like I ask this because when I look at Netflix and I see them spending $250 million or whatever on Red Notice, it hurts my head, because I just can't understand how doing that gets you or retains you as many subscribers as making like 10 hour seasons of television, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, again, the stuff that makes the most money and gets the most attention in Hollywood are the top projects. And so that's why those have outsized value and can command, you know, like even Knives Out or something, there you get a big deal for that because people are going to pay attention to it and they're going to watch it. So TV and movies are both important. They're about equally important. I think if you had to choose, you'd take a repeating TV show over a movie because it repeats. But sometimes those expensive things can be some of your most efficient money, because, you know, it's very high profile and everybody watches it and it attracts a lot of new customers. You know, there's nothing less valuable than being solid. Solid, pretty good, okay. All of these can be translated as like zero value, okay? Because you get zero new customers, zero publicity. It's just like, forget it, pass, moving on. You know, the stuff that matters is high profile, people talk about it, it wins awards, or it's just a huge hit. You know, that's what makes a difference at the end of the year. When you look back, you know, what drove our growth this year? It's that stuff. And the other stuff is mostly, you know, turns out to be kind of replaceable.
Well, you mentioned solid being worth nothing, and I want to loop back to something we had touched on very, very quickly, but didn't get to drill down on, and that's horror. Horror movies feel like the eternal low hanging fruit. You know, every year you see 10 or so, you know, $5 million horror films make $30 or $40 million at the box office. So not enormous hits, but like big enough to be profitable. But a point you make that I think is very smart that people don't focus enough on is that if you make a very solid, you know, 7.0 on IMDb, 70% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes, $5 million horror movie, that's $5 million you've lost because you can't put it in theaters and get people to show up. You're not going to make that money back on VOD. What are some of the risks and rewards in this space? Because again, I constantly feel like it's underappreciated, but maybe it's just actually kind of overfilled.
Well, I mean, my feeling is that between Jason Blum and A24, you know, you're going to be third in line, you know, in the horror, you know, for the horror stuff. And it's also, as I said, you know, just each to, you know, you should just do what you're good at. And I focus less on that and focus more on comedy, but you know, each to his or her own. But I do think that Blumhouse and A24 are really strong in that area. And I think that the economics of horror over the past couple of years have been so good that in the next few years, we're just going to see a ton of horror movies. And so I worry about the segment a little. I could be wrong, you know, but also if we get back to brand, you know, I think that all studios these days should really be a brand. And I think A24 and Blumhouse have had some success at, you know, developing themselves as a brand that matters to audiences in different categories. So A24 is kind of indie with some horror, and Blumhouse basically horror. But I think, you know, if one were to start something new, it probably don't want to be in the horror zone because that's kind of taken. But let's say we're doing a kind of more rambunctious comedy, sometimes with some indie feeling. You know, you'd have to ask whether this horror thing like fits into that. And it may or may not.
Yeah. One thing you had mentioned in a previous newsletter is having a sensitivity to the political moments. It just regardless of which side you come down on, you just have to be aware of it. Do you think that plays at all into the state of comedy or, you know, what people feel comfortable making?
Yeah, there seems to be some relationship there. But I think at the end of the day, you really have to prioritize making, you know, great movies that people want to see. That, like, you have to take the audience as it actually is in real life and do things that are funny that people laugh at. And I do think you have to be conscious of the fact that sometimes people get tripped up, you know, one way or the other politically. And, you know, don't just ignore it. You probably have to be conscious of it and, you know, try to avoid that because that would be bad.
Yeah.
easier said
than done. Yeah, I'm always surprised what gets people tripped up these days. So you can never be sure. Well, that was pretty much everything I wanted to ask. I'm trying to think here if there was anything else. But nothing is coming to mind. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked. If you think there's anything folks should know about the state of filmmaking, state of indie streaming, whatever. I mean, what do you think folks should know that we haven't talked about here?
No, you know, I think it's an exciting time because after a sort of boring couple of years, you know, I think right now the argument for movies is strong, and there are specific things to do that kind of aren't being done. So there's a clear opportunity. And so I think it's an exciting time. I do think we have to think a little bit about, you know, how do we keep the sort of indie part of the business healthy, particularly for like maybe first-time directors and stuff like that, because you do need, you know, to have Greta Gerwig create Barbie, you have to have Frances Ha as well, you know, several years ago. So you have to have a market for that. You have to have opportunities for that. And so I think some thought has to go into, you know, what's happening with this sector. Are we going to bring these theaters back to life? Does it make sense to for somebody to buy them, or like what's going on with all of that? I think that's, it would be interesting to see some good thinking in that zone.
Yeah. Do you think there's any chance that, you know, one of the studios, either Netflix, or I mean, Netflix has already bought a handful of theaters, but, you know, as we discussed, they don't really love theatrical, but like Amazon or Apple or somebody like that actually picking up some of these chains and making them a little more viable and friendly to this sort of film?
It's possible. I don't think it's irresistible, though. You know, I mean, if you were sitting in Seattle at Amazon contemplating, you know, various deals you could make on behalf of the company, I'm not sure that one gets to the very top of the list. You know, yeah. There are a lot of opportunities.
I want to lose a bunch of money on theaters.
Yeah.
Let's
I mean, how much of a difference is it really going to make to your movies? You know, if you owned AMC or Landmark, like maybe a little 5 or 10%, maybe 5. So I'm not holding my breath on that one.
All right, Roy, thank you very much for being on the show. I really appreciate it. Again, it's the Price Point Substack. You should check it out, pricepoint.substack.com. I'll link to it in my newsletter. If you enjoy my newsletter, I'm sure you will enjoy Price Point. Thanks again for being on the show.
Thanks, Sonny. I'll see you on Twitter.
I'm always there. my name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.